if I left any time for questions, I think.
Thank you, Dr. Clay. Technically, we're into our break. The nice thing is you can use your break how you'd like. So if you'd like to ask questions to Dr. Clayton or any of the other presenters, feel free. And then we also have exhibitors that would like to have you visit. And be prepared to start again about 10 o'clock. Invite everybody to sit down and gather all of your stuff. And we'll prepare for the next sessions. It is officially 10 o'clock. And I'm very excited to announce the next couple of speakers. I would like to announce that the next talk is sponsored by the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation in memory of William Riley Brown, M.D., and they are sponsoring this talk by Dr. Achar. And if there's anyone here from the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation, would you please stand so we can recognize you? I realize that those of you who are standing and shouldn't be should be sitting down. But if there's anybody from the foundation, please stand. And just in case, we'll give them a round of applause, which we appreciate. Our next talk, which is about delay in diagnosis, how we get into trouble, and listen to Bach. Now, I don't know if that's the musical composer or something else, but I'm dying to find out. And Dr. Achar, I hope I'm saying your name correctly.
Yeah.
All right. Dr. Achar teaches the Physician Assessment and Clinical Education, or PACE program, to physicians from around the country at the University of California in San Diego. And I believe that's the program that Dr. Hartman was referring to when he was speaking to us earlier. He also teaches that at the American Academy of Family Physicians Scientific Assemblies. He focuses on law in medicine. Dr. Achar completed his residency and fellowship training at the University of California, San Diego School of Medicine. He earned his medical degree from the State University of New York at Buffalo School of Medicine and is board certified in family medicine and sports medicine. San Diego Magazine, Physicians of Exceptional Excellence, has repeatedly named Dr. Achar a top doctor in its annual survey performed in collaboration with the San Diego County Medical Society. And in his spare time, he enjoys running marathons with his son. So we welcome, once again, Dr. Achar.
Yeah, great to be here. Yeah, I'm also interested if there's any good soccer players out there. So I play on the U.S. Medical soccer team. It's a bunch of old doctors, and fortunately, we're going to be playing at competition in Barcelona this summer, so we have a...
Can't hear you.
Oh, check mic. Can you hear me now? Let me move this a little closer. I'm actually looking for a good soccer player, so if you are one, come up and talk to me afterwards. We're going to go ahead and talk about medical errors, and it's actually a two-part presentation, delay in diagnosis and listen to Bach, and medical errors, and we're going to... The part two is actually concentrating about more on the future. What we're starting to see in risk management, what we're starting to see with technology invigorating healthcare and challenging us with healthcare, especially smartphones, EMR, EHR, et cetera. So let's go ahead and get started. So I start with tort law, English tort law. So William Blackstone kind of defined this. And so most of our law in medicine in the US comes from England. There's a very famous case, the Bullen case, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes. And Blackstone actually codified some of this in his analysis of laws of England, and we still use this template for us in the US. These are some of the things that the Joint Commission has seen in the last decade or so that we are going to talk a little bit about. Number one, biggest error that the Joint Commission has noted is the wrong patient, wrong site, wrong procedure. And this is devastating. When this happens, I had a physician call me after taking out the wrong kidney, and trying to find a solution to handle this error. It was a huge error. And the question really at hand was, is this physician going to be allowed to ever practice again? Yes or no? And that was the whole question. And so that's a difficult question. And ultimately, he did argue enough in favor in the administrative law court to get put on probation and have a chance to practice again. Delay in treatment, we're going to talk about that as well. It turns out delay in treatment is number two. One interesting case I was involved with in California, a patient who had been a patient of the doctor, it's an internal medicine doctor, for a while, had stopped his insurance for a few years and had stopped his Lipitor. At the time, it was a bit expensive. His salary is good, but he's a solo worker. His salary was over 100K per year, but his insurance costs were pretty high. He decided to cut that out. He ended up having some chest discomfort one morning when he went to work, told his secretary he's going to go to the doctor's office. He shows up, no appointment at all, the doctor's office in San Jose, or Fresno actually, and asked to be seen for indigestion. The nurses looked at the schedule and didn't see him on the schedule and said, well, the doctor's here today. They're all full of, they all have patients, but right down the hall we have urgent care. We take walk-ins right there, so please go there. And he said, no, I don't want to see, I want to go see the doctors in urgent care. I want to see my doctor, Dr. M. It's a real case, and he insisted upon seeing that Dr. M. So the front desk person went to the room where Dr. M was seeing a patient currently, knocked on the door, and told Dr. M what was going on, and Dr. M said, okay, let's try to help him. We have an extra room, let's put him in room 3, and as soon as I get done here, I'll go see him. So they put him in, he starts working on his cell phone, looking up the differential diagnosis of chest pain on WebMD. While the door was open, he collapses on the floor. The nurses rush over there, they call of doctors who start CPR. They get him into the ER within 2 minutes because they're very close to the hospital, but he expires in the hospital. The whole case was about, was the initial triage done by the medical assistant enough to get the doctor quicker to that room? By the time from the moment he came to ask for a visit at 8:53, he collapsed about 9:40-ish. He was in a room within 20 minutes of coming and asking for a visit, and the doctor had just been finishing his last visit. Ultimately, in a 9-4 verdict, the jury felt the doctor was exonerated and didn't blame the doctor. But the family was devastated. I was in the elevator with the family. I was going down in the elevator because I was an expert for the defense of this physician. And you could see the girls all devastated because not only they lost their daddy of unfortunate circumstances, but financially the family was very distraught because he was the sole bread earner for the family and they had no life insurance in this case. So it's such a tragedy, and delay in treatment is kind of one of the top issues on how fast we have to get to patients. Unintended retention of foreign body, we'll talk about this, post-op complications, suicide. We've had suicides in our ER, which is kind of amazing how that could happen. Medication equipment error, we're going to talk about that. Falls, oh my gosh, falls after procedures, big one. Criminal events are criminal events. So listen to Bach. So I wrote an article published in 2012 with one of my medical students at UCSD, and you can read these cases in this article, and some of these cases that I'm going to talk about are in this article. Some are newer, but listen to Bach is a mnemonic that's nice for you guys. So for the primary care doctors and the audience, this could be very helpful. L stands for lung, and the problem with lung cancer is so deadly, and delay in diagnosis here is one of the big problems, and so if we don't pick it up right away, chances are not too good. So the typical story is the male, 45-year-old, this is the one that gets missed, who's got some hemoptysis but is a smoker. That chest x-rays are negative, and we all know chest x-rays are just not enough, but the red flags don't go up enough for the physician, and CTs are not done, pulmonary consults are not ordered, and a delay of 6 months happens. By the time the patient gets comes back with worsening cancer, the argument is that 6 months enough to cause damages? And that's a trouble for the doctors. So we have to really be careful for that hemoptysis and not call it bronchitis, especially in smokers, especially folks over 50. B is breast. We're going to talk about this in big detail. Number one cause of death for women between 45 and 55 is breast cancer, and it's on our top 10 list of delay in diagnosis. A is appendicitis. These are, we've talked about appendicitis earlier today, yesterday, which was a wonderful lecture. I thought it was amazing. Here, the delay is not so much that we have to CAT scan every kid or every adult right away for symptoms of appendicitis. There's a lot of radiation toxicity there, but it's making sure we have a good discussion with the patient and the family about the potential risks and need to follow up, et cetera, and close monitoring, close follow-up is the key on these. What happens sometimes is the erroneous diagnosis of gastroenteritis. When there is no diarrhea or any other symptoms, this happens a lot in medicine. The GI system gets blamed for stuff that's a lot worse. Colon cancer, the biggest ones here that we'll probably have to really look out for is that blood in the stool, hematochezia, we see hemorrhoids, we chalk it up to hemorrhoids, we stop there. When we over 40 now, the standard of care, the guidelines, clinical practice guidelines for American College of Gastroenterology is to get a colonoscopy or get some more advanced testing to look for the colon. Normal guidelines, there's 50 and above or earlier for family history, of course. We're starting earlier, 10 years earlier in family history, or we're starting earlier for hematochezia. And H stands for the heart, so we're going to talk about that in full detail today. So this is Dennis Quaid, and you remember his daughters, they were born at Cedars-Sinai. And Cedars-Sinai is kind of an interesting place. Lots of stuff has happened at Cedars-Sinai. This family got interesting treatment. The heparin bottles got mixed up, and you can kind of see on the graph here on the slide that they look very similar. And subsequently to this case, heparin has been changed. The light-colored one is the Heplock, the 10 units. The dark-colored one is heparin IV. It's like a 10,000 units or whatever. And the dosing is logarithmic different, and indications logarithmic different. Problem in Cedars-Sinai is they were kept in a similar place. And the nurse grabbed the wrong one, and this caused, what he said, his daughter's blood to turn to water. And of course they survived, but he wasn't too happy and testified in Congress about this and how errors just can't happen. So we're going to talk a lot about Congress today and all these testimonies. So there's some data about this. The Commonwealth Fund found that 1 in 5 Americans feel that they've seen it or had a mistake done to them or their family members in a doctor's office. When the IOM came up with this first report in 2004, it shocked the nation. No one believed this is true, that 50,000 to 100,000 people died because of doctor errors. I mean, there's no other cause of it except the doctor killed them. That kind of seemed strange. There's a lot of controversy around that. Robert Wachter stepped up the ante when he wrote the book To Err Is Human, and he's a professor at UCSF. He's doing some amazing work on EPIC, where he describes now patients in one room and doctors coming around all day facing computers and never touching, talking to the patient. But in 2009, he wrote the book To Err Is Human. That further shocked the world, where he said 250,000 deaths a year in the United States, almost 1,000 a day, are caused by doctors. And people said, no way, look at the IOM report. It's much less. You can't be serious. Could these people have all gotten it wrong? Well, unfortunately, we have some even further devastating news that has happened since then. This published study this year in British Medical Journal places medical errors, doctor cause of death, as the number 3 cause of death in America, not far after cancer and heart disease. Bernie Sanders had there was a big government hearing in 2004 with members of the CDC, NIH, Harvard, and big leadership in medicine in the United States talking about this, and they quoted numbers of $1 trillion of cost per year for the 1,000 patients a day dying from doctors. So this is kind of an interesting topic, and we're going to get into it a little bit right now. So here's a term that you shouldn't know about. Hopefully you've never heard this term before, and hopefully you'll never hear it again. It's called res ipsi loquitur. It's a Latin term for the thing speaks for itself. This means that the duty of care is breached, and it can be inferred based on the act, what happened. So here's a 28-year-old female. She's 4 weeks post C-section with stomach pain. She gets an ultrasound. That's normal. She comes back 6 months later. ultrasound shows a mass, pelvis to navel area. It's a big mass, so they take her to surgery. And no, it's three. They notice it's this mass is 3 feet tall, 3 feet of her small intestine and colon with lymph nodes involved. So they remove that entire area and send it for cancer staging. And the path comes back that this was a surgical sponge. So this is one of those res ipsi locator. So there's no real defense. So if something is left in the body, there's very, very few cases that are res ipsi locator. Things left in people's bodies, surgical equipments and stuff like that, that's res ipsi locator. So what that means is there's no discussion about did you breach the standard of care. There's no discussion about that. It's just a discussion about damages. How much does this cost? That's all there is. So let's talk about another case. Here's a case of a San Diego case of a dentist who was pitching to his son in a baseball game, and he passed out in front of the fans there. It's a Little League game, and so they called 911. 911 came. His symptoms were sudden, sharp, anterior chest pain. It was pleuritic, so his pain got worse with taking a breath. Remember that story? That's kind of interesting. It was non-radiant, no diaphoresis. His blood pressure was fine. They took him to the hospital. At the hospital, they did an EKG, which is normal. They did CPK, troponins. Those are normal. They repeated those and EKGs. Those are normal. The ER physician said, look, I have no idea what's going on with you, but I'm going to admit you for observation. So they call the medical doctor of the day. Now, this is one of our big crises in America. Not only do we have this crisis of medical errors, I think the biggest crisis is a crisis of too few doctors. Just not enough of us. The cost for training doctors is too much. So we spend $1 million on each medical student at UCSD for their 4 years. It's too much money. So we have too few doctors. So this medical doctor of the day is too busy. He comes down and says, look, this guy is young. He's healthy. We can do this as an outpatient evaluation. I'll get him into cardiology, primary care. We'll get him an outpatient ETT. He's going to be fine. He looks fine. His studies are all fine. There was a discussion. The ER physician said, I don't agree with you. I think he needs to be admitted. I don't know what happened to him. Why did he pass out? This is very strange. And there was an argument. You know what happened? The MOD actually said this to the ER doctor. Said, look, you want to admit him? You admit him. I've got someone coding in the ICU. I'm gone. Bye. And the ER doctor gave in. Instead of calling somebody else, she gave in. She sent him home, and he died 6 hours later. What did he die of? He died of aortic dissection. Now, this story is an interesting story, and we'll talk about this. He had pleuritic symptoms, and a lot of arguments about this. Why is these people dying when they have pleuritic symptoms? They should be having pleuritic symptoms of the aortic dissection. Anyway, some of you guys remember Jonathan Larson. He was the playwright who wrote the musical Rent. I don't know if you ever saw that musical. It's a wonderful musical, by the way. Ever seen Rent? It was on Broadway, and one day his actors and the assistant director were calling, Jonathan, why aren't you home? Call. Jonathan, you've missed two practices. Come on, you got to get over to practice. No answer. So they go to his apartment and they find him dead on the floor. Now, Jonathan had just been to two emergency rooms in New York City. And he had been there and seen doctors. And they diagnosed him, one with gastroenteritis, even though he had no diarrhea. And I don't know what the other one was the diagnosis. He had the pleuritic chest pain. He'd been to two different ERs. And he had a widened mediastinum in his chest x-ray. At that time, it wasn't digital, so they were looking it at this. They would take the x-ray and look it up at the light and see. The resident saw the widened mediastinum. The attending said no. They sent him home. They gave him some Tagamet, and he died. And so questions abound about this aortic dissection. We're going to talk a little bit about it. First of all, the EKG, is it abnormal? No, usually it's not. His was abnormal because he was starting to have coronary disease from the dissection, but most times it's not because it's extracoronary, so we miss that. Widened mediastinum, we just are not used to seeing this. Doctors are not used to seeing it. The radiologist diagnosed this 6 hours after he was discharged, but they had no phone number, and he'd already probably died by that time. So, because radiologists are not reading the films immediately at the time. Anxiety and premonitions of death. Oftentimes, these folks, when they have this symptom of aortic dissection, they tell the doctors, I'm going to die. In fact, one case I saw with aortic dissection, the reason I picked it up is the wife and the husband, they were sent to me for back pain, low back pain, in my clinic 1 week before. And they looked weird. The exam was negative, but they looked weird. And the wife looked scared. She looked scared. So I finally rolled him over, palpated his belly. Whew, I felt this. Popped him over to the ER. They took him in that morning to the OR, fixed it. D-dimer was not ordered. D-dimer is a good test, but we typically are not thinking about PE or aortic dissection, so we don't pick this up. Okay, so chest x-rays, they're widened, and they were widened in his case, but not all the time, so not 100% sensitive. We can't use it. But the other big problem is we're not used to reading that. We're not radiologists, all of us, and we don't see aortic dissection enough. It's a once in a very rare thing. The most common physical event finding for these people is a normal exam, right? Just like our dentist, a normal exam, so we miss it. We don't get the fancy echoes which would show it. You'd see the false lumen, the real, this is the real lumen or the false lumen. We don't get that, but we don't get the CT. We certainly don't get an MRI because that's impossible to get urgently, emergently, and it's too dangerous probably to put someone in an MRI machine. So who is this guy? This is DeBakey. Now, DeBakey is very famous. Obviously, he's passed away for a lot of things. Some of his heart surgery expertise, people would fly around the world before the technology now we have where we can broadcast the surgery electronically. People would fly in and watch the surgery on the dome screen at the DeBakey Ambassador Center. He had an aortic dissection himself. Yeah, he was like 90-some years old. His chief surgeon, wanted to take him to the OR, but he said, no, I'm not signing consent. I'm not going to the OR. I'm too old. I can't survive this surgery. And the surgeon said, no, I'm going to take you to the OR. You're going. You're signing this consent. He said, no, I'm the patient. I'm not signing. There's a big decision. He said, you're going to sign. So he called. His chief surgeon calls the daughters, brings them in before they go see talk to dad. He says, look, you got 5 minutes. You go in there and you get the signature from dad. I need to take him to the OR, otherwise he's dead. So they go in, 5 minutes later, they come, here's the signature. They take him to the OR, he survives, lives 4 years afterwards and does well. Oldest man to ever have an aortic dissection surgery. Now, why did I talk about the DeBakey Institute and this story? Well, this case settled in a lawsuit against Kaiser Permanente Southern California for a couple hundred thousand dollars, but the medical board had to review these cases because it's over a certain amount. The medical board got involved. And Dr. Jelt, a friend of mine, got involved and he sent me his analysis of this, and it's very interesting. The Kaiser is not poor. So this one nice thing about working for these big organizations like a University of California, a Kaiser, we can bring in pretty much, we have infinite resources for legal liability, just infinite. So they bring in this guy, DeBakey is the surgeon that actually operated on DeBakey. He charges $10,000 a day. If you even talk to him, $10,000 every day, $10,000. Hello, $10,000. $10,000 a day. His charges were like $70,000. It was very simple. He just came in and he said this thing. He said, Your Honor, this accident, this tragedy shouldn't have happened. That if the doctor had admitted him and called us, we could have saved him. The surgeons in Kaiser would have saved him, would have saved this dentist's life. He would have been alive today. So the defense team is like, their tears are going down their eyes thinking about all the money they're spending. Then he turns around and says something interesting. He says, but Your Honor, 2/3 of American doctors are doing the same thing around the country. They're sending these patients home to die. They're not making this diagnosis. They don't see it enough. It's too rare for them. Unfortunately, they're missing it. And so if we're deciding the standard of care is what a reasonable, prudent physician would do, you're telling me that 2/3 of American doctors are not reasonable and prudent? And so the judge agonized about this, and he spent hours and hours writing his report. His report is beautiful. It's this 10-page, just like Solomon decision report. And I was like, I couldn't believe this report. And in there, he basically says the whole thing, but says, look, it's true, the error led to the death, but the error was not below the standard of care and completely exonerated the physician. And this happens sometimes. We're going to talk about what this means. So success is not required for standard of care. You can make errors. We're human. We're all going to make errors. We make errors every day. It's part of life and learning. But you don't have to be perfect to be in the standard of care. You just have to do what's reasonable and prudent. Now, tort and negligence. This comes from England. There's 4 things that you have to do wrong to get a lawsuit against you and to lose a case. You have to have a duty. You have to breach the standard of care. Just an error is not enough. That breach has to cause a harm, and there has to be some damage to the patient. And we're going to talk a lot about this today. Now, the first thing, the duty is interesting. So we should touch on this, because yesterday people were talking about Good Samaritan. I'm going to talk about Good Samaritan tomorrow in my volunteering and risk lecture. But duty of care is kind of interesting. So here's a real case, neighborhood party. comes to meet the neighborhood doctor in the party. They're drinking, they're talking. She's talking about her calf hurting and how when she runs it hurts. He says, well, okay, probably a calf strain. Doesn't do anything further, doesn't do an exam or anything. And says, I take some NSAIDs, and if you don't get better in a couple weeks, go see your doctor. So she dies a few days later of a pulmonary embolus. And the family, Susan, said she got wrong advice. And his defense was, okay, it may be true. I did miss this, but look, I'm drinking. It's a cocktail party. It's, you know, it's neighbors and friends. Come on, I'm not her doctor. You know, we have no doctor-patient relationship. What did the jury think? They said, no, you have a doctor-patient relationship. She comes to you. She knows your doctor. She asks for advice. He said, well, I didn't get any money for this. He said, well, you gave advice, and it was erroneous advice. The jury found fault with him, and he lost that case. So just because you do not make money, just because you're doing something for free, doesn't mean that you can do something wrong. And so we're going to talk about this today and tomorrow. Duty of care, we've talked about that. Proximal cause, we're going to talk about this in another case and damages. So Bolin. Now, Bolin's kind of interesting. It kind of goes to this standard of care stuff. Bolin, he argued, he is a gentleman in England who is getting electroconvulsive therapy for depression. And it helped his depression, but it was very painful. He didn't like it. And he found out his friend who got electroconvulsive therapy in London had got generalized anesthesia. And he didn't get that. And it was he was really mad. So he went to sue his doctors. And the doctors in court, they said, look, this is right. Generalized anesthesia is better than no generalized anesthesia for electroconvulsive therapy. But it had just started in London. And this was before the internet, way, way, way before the internet. And we didn't know about this. We weren't at the grand rounds. We didn't know about this paper that was published yet. It hadn't come to our community. Nobody in our community is doing generalized anesthesia at the time. For this. Now we are. We're going to do it. We promise. But at the time, we weren't. The judge said, well, yeah, so the standard of care is based on what your community physicians do in your community. So we find you not guilty. So that's the message, what a reasonable, prudent physician would do in the same or similar circumstances. Now, things have changed since the days of Bolin, right? Technology has changed, and we're going to talk about technology a lot in part two of this lecture later today. But so we're no longer in this small community. We can no longer hide in a smaller community. We're kind of in this larger Google community, unfortunately. Case number two. This is, again, goes to not enough doctors. This is a gentleman, 56-year-old man in Texas who goes to see his doctor. He went to Washington, D.C. for a dinner with President George W. Bush. It's funny, my talks, I have a lot of president stuff in there. So President Bush goes to President Bush's dinner and passes out, gets rushed over to Georgetown Medical Center. They do some stuff. They give him IV fluids, discharge him. He comes to see the doctor and talks about chest pain and also talks about lifting his computer. And this is the actual medical note. And you can see the note. This is kind of the old-fashioned note, the days we had these templates and stuff. Maybe some of us still using it. But you can see some of the history is in both the history section and down there in an assessment session. And talks about the Washington, D.C. trip and all this stuff, et cetera. An EKG was done. And that EKG is abnormal, but not much is made of it. There's a little bit of Q waves in the inferior leads, no ST changes or anything. And the patient was discharged on Celebrex for a musculoskeletal cause of chest pain, which, by the way, is the most common cause of chest pain in America in primary care clinics. So somewhat reasonable idea. Comes back 2 weeks later. Now, this is a tragedy here. This is the tragedy. She's a young doctor in this clinic who is former chief resident who had just graduated, and the system is set up, and she's set up to fail. So she has one patient at 8 o'clock with this gentleman, two patients at 8:20, another two at 8:40, and one at 9 o'clock. So you can imagine her morning schedule. It's a lot of overbooks. So she sees this guy as one of her five patients of the first hour of the morning. And we can't do this anymore. Anyway, she knows better. So she repeats an EKG. She looks at it closely, actually. And she says on the EKG, you can see no change. But there is a subtle change, and she doesn't pick it up until the deposition. So you can see the Q waves. Q waves are still there. No problem with that. However, there's a slight ST elevations that are now present in the same inferior leads, and she recognizes this on further review year later in deposition, and she admits to it, but at the time, she misses it, and I can see how you could miss it. How can you not miss this? Such a subtle change of ST changes. How can you not miss this in such a fast-running clinic where you're seeing too many patients? So later that day, the patient family calls back. Pain's not improving. The nurse takes down the note, but the doctor never gets this note because what? She's going through her care, boom, 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 rapid fire. She has no time to go to those nursing notes and telephone notes. Now, could this happen in Epic? Absolutely. In fact, it's happened to me almost once where one of my patients was complaining of lots of weird symptoms, and telephone note comes in and electronically, and fortunately, in between patients, I happened to see that telephone note, which is a crazy thought. I saw this, bring that guy in right away. I saw him, EKG showed ST elevations across the board. He was having cardiac tamponade from viral pericarditis. He went straight to the OR. It's funny, he had a big case as a Harvard attorney. He had a big case later that week, and he couldn't attend the case because he was in the OR, or in the hospital with a tube coming out of his thing, and the judge said, they called him. And he said, well, judge, I can't go. I've got a tube in my heart draining fluid. And so they said, okay, we'll give you a little break for that. All right, burden of proof. Now, this is kind of goes to the O.J. Simpson story. O.J. Simpson was declared not guilty because of this beyond a reasonable doubt. They couldn't keep track of the fluids with the DNA evidence. There was some loss between this and that, and so ultimately he got off on a technicality. In the civil case, though, they don't need as much evidence. It's clear and convincing evidence. So he's declared guilty of murder in a civil lawsuit and not guilty in a criminal lawsuit, which is kind of interesting. Now, what about for us? Unfortunately for us, we have the lowest. It's preponderance of evidence, so only 51%. That means to judge a doctor guilty, you only need 51% likelihood that they did something wrong or they met these things, which is such a tragedy. And we can't, I mean, it's beyond belief how this happens, but that's what happens. Now, telephone is one of those areas, telephone triage is one of those areas that we all have to be really careful with. Part of the problem is documentation. So we're on our car phone and someone's calling us. There's just no way you can document, right? There's just no way. And sometimes we are asked to do things that are a little tricky, like antibiotics, pain medication, and such. So this becomes a really tricky area. We talked about this case yesterday. One thing I failed to tell you about this little child, and this is a telephone case, so that's kind of brought it into this story. One thing I forgot to tell you about is the medicine that the doctor ordered on the telephone and was given to this child was fentanyl patch, the 25 microgram fentanyl patch. That's what ultimately killed this little child. So I'm not going to go over this case again. Talk about some other cases. This is a case that was admitted to our children's hospital at Rady's, where I work now. This is a little boy who is having seizures. There's an argument about the etiology, was it seizures or not? Finally, a decision was it was seizures. So the decision was to give Dilantin, but we were very tired. This is 2 a.m. This is the days, remember, where we did not have any work hour restrictions. We were in the hospital. I was in the hospital here 110 hours a week. Many of you guys know this and remember this. We get 10 admissions. Remember, we never had a chance to break, and our brains don't work well like this. There's good data that it's like driving drunk at this time of night. Our making decisions goes way down. And so ultimately, the child got 10 times the amount of Dilantin and suffered a cardiac arrest and had complications. Now, Libby Zion is the real story here because it changed healthcare. So now, the younger doctors here in the room, their work hours are restricted partly because of this case. And so Libby Zion was the daughter of an editor of the New York Times. And she had bipolar disorder, was on multiple medications, including the MAOI inhibitor, which is super dangerous. She came into the hospital, they admitted her, and the intern was doing cross cover on 40 patients, and she knew her second year resident, this is, I think it's Columbia or Cornell, second year resident was like tired, and she tried to let her second year resident sleep. When they called her about Libby, this young college student from Cornell who was struggling, the intern ordered physical restraints and Demerol, which may have done her in, because by the time a sweeping person had come into the room at 5 o'clock, Libby Zion's temperature was 105, and she coded, she didn't make it. Now, this was such a big case because her daddy was an editor of the New York Times. And it splashed over the front page of the New York Times. It went on court TV. They argued 38 counts in the medical board and criminal charges were brought. All of them ultimately were dropped, but something happened with this. Now, the doctor involved, that intern, is now a cardiologist at Stanford. But what's interesting about this case is the Bell Commission started. And the Bell Commission said, wait. We have no restriction in the number of hours that our doctors are working in the hospital, and doctors are making errors like this. We can't let this happen. Let's reduce it. So in New York, they made an 80-hour work week, which later spread around the country. And I think this is correct, to try to reduce these errors that happen. These errors happen from all different sources. Sometimes patients get the medicines at the wrong time. Sometimes they don't get the medicine. Sometimes the wrong dose. Sometimes the unauthorized drug. The unauthorized drug, you know, sometimes happens when you have too many patients in one room, and then the nurse gives the wrong patient. So it's kind of tricky. Now they're working super hard with identifications and technologies to reduce that. Here's an international case, because this happens everywhere. It's not just in the U.S., so I was getting a chance to work. I did work with Doctors Without Borders, which I'll talk about tomorrow. But I got a chance to work in Thailand for a while, and we had this one Burmese medical student. She left Rangoon, which is a terrible place at the time. Now it's much better, but a terrible place at the time, and walked all the way to Bangkok. And by the way, on the way, she got malaria, which is pretty obvious. If you're going to walk through the jungle from Burma to Bangkok, you're going to get malaria. It's about 1,000 miles. So she got malaria. We gave her quinine. And what happened? Well, the nurses called us and said, her fevers are better, but she says she can't see. She can't see. So we went down to see her. Couldn't see at all. What had happened was the QD had been mistranscribed as QID. And the nurses were giving the quinine 4 times a day instead of 1 a day, which really clobbered out her malaria, but also caused a retinal toxicity. Fortunately, it was temporary. We fed her, washed her, and a few days later, her vision came back. But that makes me think, some of these abbreviations, we've got to go away with them. With technology and electronic prescribing, it's better, so we don't have this as much. It's all written out as words, so when you type in this, it comes out as words. But if you're still using paper, these things are fraught with error, because you can get problems with the dosing when you use these abbreviations. And even if you get abbreviations for drug names, you get errors too. Now, it's interesting, UCSD did a little survey. We found that the peak of these errors happens in July. Now, what happens in July? Yeah, new interns. A 10% bump in medication errors for the new interns. It totally makes sense. I can totally see that. I remember making an error just like that, too. So, okay, here's a really unfortunate case I was involved with. It was 1994. This is my internship year, so now you date me a little bit. This is a child I saw. This is a child that changed America in a sad way. So good and bad for all of us in the room here. This child fell off a skateboard, went to our local emergency room, got x-rays. The radiologist read them, but later, the ER doctors thought it was a contusion and discharged the patient home. This patient never walked again. So about a month later, parents come back into the ER with their 6-year-old saying, he's not better, he's not walking. And the ER doctors go, what? And so they examine him and they look at the report and they couldn't believe the report. The radiologist had seen a lytic lesion on the x-ray and they said, this is consistent with osteosarcoma, Ewing's osteosarcoma. They had written that down, and then they had faxed that report to a primary care doctor who had yet to see this patient. It was assigned in a group, but had never seen the patient. The medical assistant who got the faxes off the fax machine saw this, went to look for a chart. There was no chart. So she created a chart for this one fax. And then she looked for a doctor, but there's no doctor along with this. There's no doctor connected to this patient. So she tried to shop around. No one paid attention to this chart, and it just sat there for a month. So no one looked at this. No doctor looked at it. Just a medical assistant and a radiologist. No one else. So they admit this child now, but now this time, a month later, the child's got a path fracture through there. It's through the hip, actually. And in the room, I was there. Mom asked the surgeons who were there, well, if this was, because they talked to her, they said the only treatment is amputation of his leg. And she's mom said, well, if they had been diagnosed a month before when he didn't have a fracture, could you have fixed that fracture and taken this out? And the surgeon said, yes, we could have fixed it then, but we can't now. Path fracture, Ewing's osteosarcoma, dangerous. We've got to do an amputation. So this went to, went to trial. Rady Children's Hospital did not want to go to trial with this. This is a very bad case. Nothing good about this case. They wanted to settle. They offered millions of dollars to the family. The family said no. So they go to trial, and in trial, what did the jury think? Who do they think was most responsible for this error? Who? Radiologists, you're exactly right. They said, oh my gosh, you saw this. You should have called somebody. You should have called somebody. So radiologists couldn't say no to that. They really couldn't say no to that. The fax is just not enough. They didn't call somebody. And so they got the settlement for the trial turned out to be $1.5 million for radiology, $300,000 for the primary care or the ER doctors for not checking the results of the x-ray that they ordered, and $150,000 for the primary care doctor, pediatrician, who'd never seen the patient, by the way, partly because they hadn't a system set up to make sure that results were handled when they came in electronically by a doctor, and a doctor saw them. So all of this happened because of this one case. But why is this case so important? Well, today, now, if radiologists see stuff, most times, fractures, cancer, something bad, infection, they get on the phone and they call you and then they put your name on it. Why? What are they doing? It's imagine football. So Clay Matthews is rushing you. You're the quarterback, and he's about to kill you. You got the ball, and you immediately see, fortunately, you got a nice running back right next to you. So you hand the ball. No longer can Clay Matthews hammer you. He's not allowed. He goes after the guy with the football, and so hammers that running back. Fortunately, you're saved. So that's what radiologists are doing. They're handing the football away. As soon as they get into trouble, they see something dangerous, they put someone's name on it. Now your name's on it. Now if you don't want to get in trouble, you either deal with it or hand it off to somebody else and document that yourself. Because otherwise, Clay Matthews is coming after you. So red flags, we kind of talked a little bit about some red flags. Night pain is one, we'll talk about this in a second. Constitutional symptoms, trauma. With kids especially, you have to be careful because non-accidental trauma happens and it gets explained as regular trauma, so we have to be a little cautious with that. Growing pains, I'm not going to talk about this in much detail. So here's another story I saw at the same time at the same hospital. Anyway, this is a boy with back pain. He's writhing in bed with back pain. So at 2 in the morning, writhing in bed, that just doesn't sound right. And his underwear was soiled. That also didn't sound right to me. But again, I'm tired. I'm an intern. I don't know a lot. And most of my knowledge at the time of low back pain was lumbar strain, which I don't use as a diagnosis nowadays for different reasons. But at the time, I did. And I said, this has got to be that. So I ordered a bunch of useless blood tests, totally useless, and went away. But I knew something was wrong. So about 3 in the morning, I come hunting back this family on this child. And what was weird about this when I came back is there's the white shirt, white coat sign. There's a lot of long white coats outside the room. And that was not a good sign at 5 in the morning, including the head of our pediatric neurology. That was also not good because it seemed a bit early for him to be showing up in the hospital. So I went in and I listened. And at this time, the child had a level. And what he had was actually transverse myelitis. Now, this map up on this screen is important. Part of the problem for me was language. And the family and the patient only spoke Spanish. And my Spanish was not the best at the time. And I was reaching out for nurses to help me, but they were busy. They said, call AT&T. And I was tired, and I didn't want to do this computer AT&T thing at the 2 in the morning. And I failed a little bit. I don't think it mattered. There's no lawsuit. 3 hours later, diagnosis doesn't change anything in a prognostic standpoint. This case I'm going to skip through a little bit except for a couple little things. This is a real case of a boy that got diagnosed late with the DDH. And the problem in this case is mom's a pediatrician and kept telling the pediatrician, head of our pediatrics practice at UCSD at the time, that she was worried about her child having DDH. The pediatrician did his exams and didn't feel much and discounted her, which is something we have to be very careful not to do. If a patient and a doctor disagree, I think we need another opinion. Either advanced imaging, advanced test, or doctor, because this is where things go wrong sometimes in healthcare. So anyway, if you were to try to diagnose it, you could do this an x-ray and see the acetabulum that's shallow and doesn't have and angled up, but this is too much for our presentation. This one slide, the reason I have this here is just thinking about risk factors and this phrase I say, concentrate the glory, share the blame. So if you're a baby born breech and you are firstborn and you're a girl, the chance of you having DDH is probably about 10%. So if you're comfortable, you're an orthopedic surgeon, you're comfortable dealing with this and knowing how to examine, how to follow this, no issues. If you're a really good doctor, family doctor, and you do this a lot, you're comfortable. But if you're not, concentrate to glory, share the blame. These are good referrals. Refer these out, and other people can figure out what to do. The best test we have, sometimes we get enamored by technology, but the really best test at 2 weeks is Ortolani Barlow. Ortolani is a nice Italian pediatrician. Barlow's an English surgeon who later figured out ways of taking the hips out and putting the hips back in. That's the best way, the physical exam. We sometimes lose the art of the physical exam, thinking technology's perfect. You do technology at this time, like ultrasound, you get a false positive. It's really physical exam is our answer for this. And these always end up losses. Now, the reason I put this slide is a couple little points. The double diaper, why does that happen? Well, a doctor suspects it, but doesn't really believe it. He's kind of like, maybe you have it, so let's just double diaper. That's malpractice. Now, if we suspect something bad, we have to investigate and treat it. We can't just like leave it alone and half treat it. Half treatments are no treatments. So this is a no treatment. So if you think something, if you don't think it, no problem. But if you think it, treat it or get an evaluation to figure it out. Now I did tell you I'm going to talk about breast cancer, and this is a good story. This is a patient at University of California who comes in to see her doctor for a lump in her right breast. The doctor evaluates it, finds it, calls it a fibroma, which is a little interesting to do that on physical exam, orders a screening mammogram, and no clinical history is on the form. The radiologist does a screening mammogram, sees nothing, but then the patient comes back and gets another ultrasound. Ultrasound is now another test, ultrasound negative. Then patient becomes pregnant and goes to see her doctor. She mentions it to her doctor who does a biopsy, and finds breast cancer and says, well, we got to treat you. You got breast cancer. I think we have to do an abortion and treat you. She says, nope, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to carry a baby and we'll treat after. So she does. But by the time she gets her full staging afterwards, she's stage 2B and she sues everybody. Now, in the defense, it was an argument between the two sides. This never goes well, by the way. When the two sides of the defense, two different people defending in a defense situation, arguing against each other, not good. So radiologist said, look, we did miss this. We now look back at that mammogram. You can see this lesion. But we didn't have any clinical history. The doctor didn't even bother to write one line saying that they felt a mass, or the patient was complaining of a mass, or where that is, or anything to give us. And a screening test, we're not around. Like a diagnostic test where we do more views, four views, and where somebody's around, talk to the patient. We're not around. We don't know. This is just a screening test for us. If the family physician had only told us a little bit more, we'd have done a diagnostic test, and we'd have picked this up. The family physician said, look, come on, you're the radiologist, you can see it now, you should be able to see it before. And so there's an argument, what happened? Well, as you might imagine, the family physician lost here, the pretrial settlement of $1.9 million. It's interesting, 7-month delay, $1.9 million. It's kind of interesting just from a numbers standpoint. We talked about breast cancer. This is the age group that is the highest risk for death, and so kind of have to keep this on the list. The problem with screening tests in general is you can get false negatives, and mammogram is no different. In fact, in premenopausal women, it's very commonly a false negative, and so you have to be especially careful, and a lot of malpractice cases with breast cancer happen because doctors don't refer patients to a surgeon that can do a biopsy. When they feel a mass, they just do a screening mammogram or diagnostic mammogram in some cases and stop at that point. Okay. So I did go a little fast, but that's great. I can have time for questions. This is what I'm going to talk about in part two later. So the newer stuff in malpractice, what's coming in the future? I especially think this is good for the doctors, especially young doctors who might be using technology, a lot of technology in this next talk. We're going to talk about causation and whether you can use causation as a legal defense. We're going to talk about spending and risk, new data from the NIH about spending and risk, and this is coming up in part two. And then we're talking about documentation and how this really can help us, but also sometimes get us into trouble, and the 4 C's of risk management. Since I raced through a little bit fast, I have plenty of time for some questions. That you have there is in your handouts too. So we went through, it's all in there.
What about patient compliance? A lot of patients, we tell them they have to have like a CAT scan and then they cancel, or you schedule them for a colonoscopy and they cancel and we don't get it back that they canceled. What is our liability in that regard?
So the problem with medical malpractice is it's a jury. And the juries are peers, and most times they like us, by the way. So 80 to 90% of cases that go to trial end in favor of the physician. However, it's a little bit of a risky thing here. We can never blame the patient, but the way the defense goes is, look, we ordered the right test, we ordered the right referrals, we gave patient information about doing this. So this is where the after-visit summary comes in. So giving patients something when they leave the office is very valuable here. So if you hand them a form, because they'll argue, and sometimes correctly, that the doctor never did. And I'm going to talk about a case in my second section where the doctor supposedly referred, but the patient says, no, they never referred me. And in paper, there's nothing there to document the referral, so it looks bad for the doctor. So I think our duty is a little bit over and beyond what it should be, I have to say, but we have to remind the patient more than once to do their test and or their referral, and we have to document it in our medical note and explain in a reasonable, prudent way why we told the patient they need to do this. And theoretically, if we can give them something to take home, like an after-visit summary, something that says, here is your follow-up visit, see this surgeon or see this, go get this test, and here's the number, then you're golden.
Yes, sir. You'd mentioned that you don't use lumbar strain as a diagnosis. Maybe you're going to talk about that later, but could you elaborate on that?
Well, it's interesting because, technology is changing the way we're thinking about diagnosing a lot of things, and I think MRI has now changed the way we think about the back a little bit and what is actually causing back injuries. And, it's interesting. In children, for example, I do work at Rady Children's Hospital, and I see a lot of stress fractures, a lot, in our kids. And we overdiagnose muscle injuries in kids all the time. And the muscles are actually the strongest thing that they have, but their growth plates are their weakest. And so we'll see spondylolysis, very common in kids. And in adults, we see a lot of arthritis and discogenic causes of pain, and it gets better. But if you look at your MRI reports, you'll never see any muscle injuries on there. And so we overcall the muscle strain. Now, I'm not saying if you're a wide receiver for the Steelers and you're going out there every day and you're getting pounded that you're not getting a lumbar strain. You absolutely are. But if you're sitting at your desk and you wake up one morning, you just get up from your desk and all of a sudden your back hurts, it's not really that. So it's a different topic, but not really that critical. I think the key is some of the diagnoses that we want to make, like I made in this child with transverse myelitis, that we're used to making may not be the correct diagnosis.
So we get multiple letters each week from insurances and pharmacies saying our patients aren't taking their lisinopril, citalopram, Crestor, Lipitor, whatever it is, probably a dozen, 36 pages each week. How important is it to follow up on each one of those?
I just throw those away. Now, it's not because we can't do better with that, and we just don't have enough time to frankly track down all our patients and say, take the medicines. The majority of our patients probably do, but at least a third don't. You know, when you pick them up when they come to the office and their blood pressure is still high, and you say, well, and they say, oh, doc, I forgot today. And okay, all right. But, the sad part for us is we're being now remunerated for like our blood pressure numbers for our patients. So it's a real tricky game. But I don't think we have time to really go back and follow up on all these things. The things, there are a few areas. So remember, listen to Bach, lung, breast, appendicitis, colon, heart. These cases, by the way, for family physicians make up 85% of lawsuits. Delay in diagnosis is everything in primary care. And so if you are thinking of those things, we should hunt our patients down and make sure they're getting those tests.
This doesn't have a clear answer, but just as a relatively younger physician, I hear lectures like this and I want to image everybody who complains of anything. And then our lunchtime lecture is about less medicine, better health. How did we find that equilibrium in our practice where we're protecting ourselves but not opening up Pandora's box?
You know, I think patients first. Patients first is the key. And one of the problems with imaging and CT for appendicitis is radiation exposure. And so we have to be cognizant of that. But I don't think our job is to keep healthcare costs down. We are getting in trouble here. And if you look at data I'm going to present later from the NIH, it shows that doctors who spend more actually get sued less. So, and this is new data, unfortunately, but I think we should, as a country, needs to make a decision on healthcare costs. But individual doctors, your job is patient first. So if you think a patient needs a test or referral and you're not sure, just do it. You're much less likely to be held accountable for doing some, referring a patient to somebody else, conscious degree, share the blame, or doing an extra test that's not dangerous.
A physician in South Carolina, I believe, last year was successfully sued after diagnosing a patient with hypertension, ordered the medication, patient didn't pick it up, died of a heart attack a month later, family sued, and they were successful. So comment on that.
It's kind of a weird thing. I haven't seen that myself, and I have to look at that case to find out more. It doesn't sound right. You know, most of this stuff in legal world, it's common sense stuff. It doesn't, if that doesn't sound right. I've seen reports where doctors are taking care of patients for blood pressure, for example, and are not doing physicals, and the patient's not getting their annual screening, and we'll talk about that and the need for annual screening. But I haven't seen that, what you describe, where you write the correct medication and the patient doesn't pick it up and gets you. That's kind of odd.
I want to thank you for some really interesting talks to the past 2 days. You've kind of left us in the lurch, though. How many patients do you think die every year because of physicians?
So we don't know. So the NIH and the CDC folks are now looking at this very closely. The new report from the British Medical Journal, which is a good study that's published this year in April, said 251,000 die from medical errors. The problem is this. Patients in the hospital, they go in because they're sick. They have organ failure. They're really bad. And it's hard to determine sometimes, like, what the ultimate cause of death was. Was it the organ failure itself, or was it a medical error? And so this is a tricky thing. And plus, none of us are going to own up to it. I'm not going to. And you're probably not either. We're not going to say, oh, I caused it. Boom, and write that on the death certificate. So this is a tricky area. I have to say, though, that more medicine is not better medicine. So we laud ourselves as having the best healthcare in the world, but our outcomes are not the best. Our outcomes are far below the outcomes we're seeing in a lot of countries in Europe, in Canada, and some countries in Asia now. And I wonder if doing more is not always the best thing. Now, maybe from a legal standpoint, it may be good, but not always the best thing. And we'll talk about that in part two.
Just another question. A lot of the patients say, well, I don't want my mammogram because I don't want the radiation exposure. And then the other one is that we're supposed to do these CAT scans on the smokers, but the insurance doesn't cover them. So what is our liability when a patient refuses to do a screening test? And number two, if the insurance doesn't pay for it?
I don't think you have a liability on if a patient refuses a screening test. You order a screening test. This is what I do. I say, okay, if I want to do something for a patient, I have a really nice documentation tool that I use, and patient doesn't want it, I say, look, I discussed the risks and benefits. The patient understands that I want them to see a surgeon, or I want them to do this test, but they don't want to do it at this point, and so I'm going to do the next best thing to help them. So never abandon patients. So they don't want the first best thing, say, okay, I'm going to do the next best thing. Document that in your medical record. I've never seen a physician lose a lawsuit in that case, never.
I just had a question. We've talked a lot about overworking too many hours in the hospitals, but what about in the clinic? Is there a fine line of seeing too many patients in a day? I'm sure that there's not a direct answer here, but too many patients in a day that is deemed not safe for a physician to see. If you're seeing them every 5 minutes, every 15 minutes, how much is too many?
This is a great question. We need to answer this question collectively. As a group, doctors, we should make up the solution. We should make up the answer here. We need to come up with a reasonable amount of time that we can see patients, answer their questions, do a proper physical exam, review the medical record, and have somebody else help us do the documentation. So we cannot just have to see like 100 patients a day. It's malpractice. It's wrong. And we should We should see it only the number that we have time for. And how much that number is depends on your specialty, depends on the support staff that you have. But we as a collective nation of doctors need to come up with this answer. And we should do it for not just for patient health, it's also for our well-being.
A follow-up to Dr. O'Brien's question. Has an insurance company ever been found culpable for a delay of diagnosis when they have not authorized one of the tests that we order, like an MRI of a back?
No, I haven't seen that. But you know what's interesting is hospitals. And we're going to talk about the most new doctors nowadays. When we leave residency fellowship, we're not doing solo practice. Most new doctors now, because I teach at a residency, they're all joining these big groups. Now, the big groups get sued as well as the doctor. And unfortunately, when it comes to making a decision on settlement, sometimes the bigger groups make decisions that may not be the best for the primary doctor. But you know what? The insurance company should take the blame. They're saying, no, we can't do the MRI or we can't do this referral, and then something happens. It's their fault. But I've never seen that, really. I don't know if anybody else has. So one last question, and then we're going to take a break, and I'll be outside to answer questions if anybody has.
But let me comment on whether insurance companies have been sued. In California, a lady wanted a bone marrow transplant for breast cancer treatment. It was denied by the California insurance company. They sued the family, got $23 million, and that was the beginning of doing bone marrow transplants for breast cancer in this country and everywhere else. It was based on information coming out of Australia. Later on, after we'd spent billions of dollars doing this, found out it wasn't good. The data in Australia had been falsified. So there's two lessons there. One, insurance companies can be sued, but the university or whoever was the investigator in Australia falsified his data, and we all followed it primarily because of that lawsuit, and it turned out to be false.
Yeah, I remember that. Thank you very much. Good point. All right, thank you guys.